Steve, this council is going to appear by WebEx. Council, is it Mr. Dugan?
Yes, Your Honor, I'm here.
Very good. And Ms. Klein, you are here in the courtroom today. Either council have any questions before we begin?
No, Your Honor.
Very good. Mr. Dugan, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Please, the court and counsel, Brand Dugan for the appellant. This is a case where the defendant had filed a motion for discharge. A evidentiary hearing was held on it. Calculation was attributed. And there were 35 days left remaining on that speedy trial. No appeal was taken therefrom. Trial was scheduled past those remaining 35 days. After the expiration of those 35 days, defendant filed further motion for discharge. Evidentiary hearing was set. The state filed a motion to quash. And at that time, a hearing was held on October 8th, 2020. However, no order was ultimately filed from November 17th. The issues before the court is whether or not the district court erred in one, granting the state's motion to quash and implicitly thereby denying the defendant's motion for discharge. The state's primary reliance, both at the time of the motion to quash hearing, as well as in their brief, has been the Mortensen case. The issue in Mortensen is distinguishable from the facts here, as Mortensen involved an appeal, denial, remand, and then subsequent. The issue that we have here is that there was no appeal. The rationale in Mortensen was that under the statute, a motion for discharge is treated as a motion for continuance, and thereby a waiver if it extends the time beyond the 180 days. However, there was no appeal taken. And Mortensen discusses a lot as far as what the basis for that determination is. The state, I think in their brief, wanted to talk about some specific language for Mortensen, page 166 of that opinion. Implicit within the motion for discharge is a request for continuance until the issue has been completely resolved. However, if the court looks at the paragraph just preceding that, the court noted at that time that the motion functions as a request for a continuance because the motion must be resolved by completion of the appeal process before the trial be commenced. Motion which necessitates an adjournment is equivalent to an application for a continuance. Court went further on to say, consequently, if a defendant files a notice of appeal from a denial of the speedy trial claim, the trial court is divested of jurisdiction until the issue has been resolved by the appellate court and the mandate has been entered. No appeal was taken. It was ripe for review.
Counsel, even though no appeal was taken, your motion still had the effect of continuing the trial, did it not?
As a pretrial motion, I would agree. I think the distinction of Morrison is we treat the, so under 4A of the statute is the general pretrial motions. Those are counted against the defendant. 4B are continuances specifically. So there's delays and continuances. Every motion that's filed constitutes a delay under 4A that then gets attributed to the time for trial against the defendant. It is a continuance that is subpart 4B that becomes the continuance and the waiver that's discussed in Mortensen. So a motion for discovery.
Why is an unsuccessful motion to discharge that's appealed a continuance, But an unsuccessful motion to discharge that's not appealed, not a continuance. Why is that the case?
Because in the discussion of Morrison about why the statute does not explicitly say that a motion for discharge shall be construed as an appeal. That comes from the holding of Morrison. And I believe the rationale of Morrison is that why we treat these as this extra level that ultimately can end in a waiver and denial is because the divestment of jurisdiction to the trial court that would then become part of the appeal. And so nothing can be done there. Analogously, other pretrial motions, yet again, from the time that are filed until they're resolved, those get counted against the defendant under 4A because you can't have a trial during those, but it's not a continuance in the same way. We're asking for a ruling on an order. So by way of analogy, a motion to suppress that would be filed, that would be told against the defendant until the order be issued. And that could be, it doesn't necessarily operate as a waiver because the court can take that under advisement as well before issuing the order, which may delay what the trial proceeding was. And while that would not be fair to the state under that 180 days, it does get attributed against the defendant under 4A as being an extension of that time. And so I think that's the character between the two, is that a bright line rule that any motion for discharge, I don't think that's the ruling of Morrison. It is because of the divestment of jurisdiction. But without the divestment of jurisdiction, that rationale is not there, and it falls more under the 4A. I think that the other part is that under these matters, we have an issue of what evidence is before the court. I think that under the res judicata collateral estoppel doctrine, there was a hearing, no contestant as far as what those calculation of dates was taken. So I think that those are facts that have been termed by the court and that the state cannot complain of now. The issue then is what happened. I think we can take, just on the record from the Bill of Exceptions and the transcript, calculation of those dates showing that they occurred after the time that was allocated and that the second motion for discharge was properly filed after that time. And so thereby those dates become things that are not of such a nature that we would have to remand the matter. And I believe that based upon that, we have the issue that the court can issue its order, basically vacating the motion to quash and granting the motion for absolute discharge of the defendant in these cases. The large
Counsel,
courts, sorry.
Did the motion for absolute discharge have the effect of taking the trial date past the original 6-month period as extended by any other periods of delay which were been resulting from other motions other than the motion for absolute discharge?
Well, yet again, Your Honor, if on the first motion for discharge, if we take the court held or the trial court held that the time for discharge had not run at the time of the filing of the initial, in a sense, there were 35 days left. Under a 4A that thereby moves and extends. The same would be analogous of a motion for motion to suppress.
I'm not sure you understood my question. My question was, at the time the motion for absolute discharge was heard and ruled upon, had the motion for absolute discharge taken the case past the original 6-month period as it might have been extended by any other periods of delay?
The order So the hearing on the motion for discharge was filed July 6th. The trial court ruled on it August 13th. The original or the extended COVID trial date had been July 20th. Believe that. So it was under advisement during those time periods.
Didn't the court determine on its order on the first motion for discharge that the state had until August 10th to bring the defendant to trial? And then didn't the court not rule on that until August 13th?
That is correct. I see that I'm out of time unless the court has any other questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Klein. Morning to you. You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, Mr. Chief Justice. My name is Kimberly Klein. I'm Assistant Attorney General representing the state in this matter. Your Honor, we believe Mortensen absolutely does apply to this case. And I think the reason it does is first you have to look at Mortensen and its context. At the time Mortensen was decided, we were awash in a flood of speedy trial appeals. And Mortensen was this court's interpretation of a legislative change that had been made in order to stem that flood. And that legislative change was to basically add in the language that a defendant was deemed to have waived their right to a speedy trial when the period of delay resulting from a continuance made at the request of the defendant extended the time of the trial date beyond the 6 months. Now, Mortensen, up until Mortensen, basically every single speedy trial case had in fact been appealed. And I'm sure it hasn't escaped this court's notice that once the Mortensen opinion issued, that flood dried up like the Colorado River. We've seen virtually none since then. And I don't think that's, I think that's exactly because of Mortensen. Now, Mortensen does say that in order to have, essentially they're three things you have to have. The filing of the motion results in the continuance of the timely trial date outside the 6 month period that the motion for discharge is denied, and that denial was affirmed on appeal. I think what this court was driving at that point was that you needed finality of it. You needed to have a final order. Well, a motion for discharge that is not appealed and the time for appeal runs is no less a final determination of that motion for discharge than it would be if additional time was consumed in appealing the speedy trial order. And I think that's really what this court was driving at, because up until Mortensen, everything had been appealed. Literally, everything had been appealed. But once Mortensen came down, what you're really looking at is you need essentially the finality of having a determination on the motion for discharge. And if the order denying discharge isn't appealed, you've still got a final ruling on the thing. And that's, I think, what really Mortensen was driving at. So we think the rationale of Mortensen applies with equal force when the first motion for discharge wasn't appealed, as it would if it had been appealed like it had been prior to Mortensen, in some cases 4 and 5 times. I think that's really what the court was driving at in this. And Justice Castle, you were correct that on the first motion for discharge, the time had actually elapsed by about 3 days. The motion for discharge was filed July 6th, at which point in time the last trial date would have been August 10th. The district court resolved the motion for discharge by denying it on the 13th of August, which basically puts us 3 days past that 6 month period. So the eternal waiver, as we like to call it, had been taken in effect by statute. And
I beg your pardon. By reference to the statute, or perhaps by Mortensen, was the filing of the initial motion for discharge, did it have the effect of a continuance?
Did it have the effect of what, ma'am?
Of a continuance.
Yes. Yes. According to Mortensen, that the filing of a motion for discharge is essentially a continuance made at their request of the defendant, because it's a motion that he's filed and basically trying to avoid the speedy trial he didn't want in the first place.
Trial was scheduled for July 20th at that point, correct? And so the motion had the effect of continuing that trial to some later date.
Correct. Exactly. Exactly. And
however,
so
I beg your pardon, the further discussion in Mortensen of divesting the trial court of the jurisdiction during the course of the appeal is perhaps not essential to the ruling in Mortensen. Is that correct?
That would be accurate.
Can I ask a question about what the district court actually did here? It purported to grant a motion to quash.
Yeah.
And opposing counsel, I believe, said that by doing that, it implicitly overruled the motion for discharge. Would you agree with that?
I think so. Yeah, it did not actually make a ruling on the motion for discharge. They had a hearing on the motion to quash. It granted that, which
is a motion to quash filed in opposition to a motion for absolute discharge a thing?
It's the first time I've seen it. So I have to say that, yeah, I guess, I don't know if you'd file a motion to quash or a motion to dismiss or maybe just an opposition to it. It's just the state was making known its opposition to the thing. And I'm not sure that.
There is a statutory motion to quash an information.
Right.
But there's no statutory motion to quash someone else's motion.
Not that I'm aware of. Yeah, right. It's kind of freestyling legal practice, I guess. I think you could file maybe a motion to dismiss or maybe even just an opposition or something. I don't know that's really what it was, as an opposition to his motion, and kind of working backwards by the district court's granting that, it operated as a functional denial of the motion for discharge. Like I said, it's kind of freestyling, but I think it gets us where we need to go. So
did the court go on to schedule trial?
Yes. When it denied the motion on August 13th, it reset trial for, I believe, September 21st. And then on the 18th of September, the defendant filed her second motion for discharge.
And did the court schedule yet another trial date when it purported to grant the motion to quash?
I don't recall, Your Honor. Your Honors, unless there are additional questions, we would ask that this court affirm the whatever ruling of the district court and remand the case for trial in this matter. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have any time for rebuttal? Very good. Counsel, Mr. Dugan, thank you for appearing by WebEx. You are excused.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You are excused, and we will go on to the next case of the day, which is Becker versus Becker.